Ladies and gentlemen, it was a cold-blooded, premeditated murder.
Hi everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Red and Buried podcast. I'm Frankie, and today I'm delighted to be joined by the wonderfully talented, incredibly prolific knitter, Mandy Robotham.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming on. I talk about it a bit in your bio, a bit of a spoiler there, but you're an incredible knitter. I'm in awe of your skill.
I knit funny things. I knit weird things, as my kids tell me. I knit very odd things like placentas and animals and fruit and silly things. So I get very bored very easily.
I love it. Yeah. Well, why not? I think there's too many, like, you know, normal, like, I don't know, what do you knit? Jumpers. There were some good jumpers. I saw you knitted some jumpers as well. They were very good.
I have knitted ordinary things.
No, I wish I could knit. I've never been able to figure it out, so I'm in awe of your skill.
Well, I take it everywhere with me, much like I take my laptop everywhere with me. I take my knitting, and people talk to you. It's like having a dog. When I've got the dog with me and the knitting and the laptop, people really do talk to you. So
I was gonna say, do you get any work done?
I mean, you can sort of, you know, put your headphones in and close down, but apart from that, I pick up some good conversation that sometimes make it into the books.
Oh, that's good. That's useful then. Yeah. Wow. I was going to say, you get some pearls of wisdom. Knit pearl one. Is that a knitting phrase?
Yeah. Knit one pearl one.
There you go. I don't know. Really. Thank you. I won't needle you with any more puns. Sorry, I will stop now. But we're not here to talk about stupid knitting puns. We're here to talk about you and your fantastic new book. So I have got a little bio about you that I'll read out now, and taken from online sources, as is the way. Hopefully it's all correct, but please do tell me if anything is wrong.
That's
okay. Fantastic. And also, I should have checked before we started, but it is Robotham, isn't it?
It's all sorts, but it's Robotham mainly.
Robotham, yeah. Sorry. Okay, Robotham. Okay. Mandy Robotham is a Globe and Mail, USA Today, and UK, Canadian, US, and Australian Kindle top 100 bestseller. That is an impressive mouthful to have around your name. Very, very good. She's been an aspiring author from the age of 9, but was waylaid by journalism and later enticed by birth, which is a brilliant sentence, a brilliant phrase. She's now a former midwife who writes about birth, death, life, love, and everything in between. She graduated with an MA in creative writing from Oxford Brookes University. Her sixth novel, The Hidden Storyteller, is her first foray into crime. Writing about it, not committing it, I'm assuming.
Yes, definitely. Well, I hope so.
We'll see. So, the war is over and Germany is in ruins. Posted to an Allied-run Hamburg, reporter Georgie Young returns to the country she fled 7 years prior, at the onset of the conflict, to find it unrecognizable. Amidst the stark horrors of a bombed-out city crumbling under the weight of millions of displaced souls, she discovers pockets of warmth, a violinist playing amidst the wreckage, couples dancing in the streets, and a nation trying to make amends. Joining forces with the local detective Harry Schroeder to catch a killer targeting women on the city streets, curiosity draws Georgie deep into the dark underbelly, and she soon discovers that the darkest secrets of the war did not die with Hitler. Oh boy, it's such a brilliant synopsis, really. Outside of writing, Mandy lives in Stroud with her family, featuring her beautiful dogs. Is it just the one dog or two? Because I saw a few on your Instagram.
No, just the one. But he's quite popular on social media.
Yeah, he's gorgeous. And, you know, one is more than enough, I think. But that's a good shout. As well as being a talented writer, she's also a fantastic knitter and an all-round lovely person.
Thank you. That's a nice word.
It's all just facts. Well, it's all true. You know, I can always tell. Obviously, we've never met before. Hopefully, one day we will in person. But I can always tell, like, the vibe of someone's Instagram account. You post nice things, and you're a positive person, and you're very engaged with the writing community as well. From what I could see on your Twitter,
I think it's really important to do that, because I'm a reader and I love to engage with other writers. And, yes, you know, when you get that kind of contact, it's brilliant. And so any writer knows that you're most of the time you're writing into a void. You're sitting in your living room or your bedroom or your somewhere, and you're writing into this void. And that contact that you have is absolutely vital. The tiniest little tweet can really lift your day when you're having a, when you're sort of wading through treacle on the words. It really.
Yes. Especially what I love about it is, it's so encouraging to hear, is that everyone's so supportive of one another, and it's not competitive.
No.
Which it could easily be.
No. And that's also the great thing about, I think, the crime community. So I've been to the yes. Harrogate Festival a couple of times, sat there as a punter in the audience thinking, oh, I want to be a crime writer. And it's all because there's such a nice bunch of people. There's a lot of laughter, fair bit of drinking, but, you know, there's they have a laugh in the midst of talking about how to cut up a body and, you know, and that sort of. So it's one of the communities that I've been desperate to get into for some time. And I hope with this that I've got a toe in the door.
I think you definitely have. Like, what an incredible plot you have here. So obviously war is a whole subject in itself a lot of the time, and obviously you come from a historical writing background, so your step into crime with it though is genius. Especially I always think about that period in history where there were probably so many murders going on, but nobody really did much because there was so much else happening in, you know, during the war and things like that. Absolutely. There was so, infrastructure was just decimated, wasn't
absolutely
it?
It's very easy to hide a body in wartime and in post-war when the bodies were still being found. So it's a very opportune time for killers and murderers. And it went on, you know, life went on in every single way, shape and form, including people killing each other for no reason at all. Not that war is ever a reason to kill anybody, but, you know, outside of the theatre of war, there were still normal things happening. Unfortunately, one of those normal things is murder.
Yeah, we also have a real golden age for murderers that period. Like, what a dream.
There's a fantastic book written, and I can't remember who's written it, but it's called something like The Secret Life of the Blitz. And it goes through all the crimes and the sort of underhand things that were going on in the middle of the Blitz. Wow. So, yeah, opportune burglars shitting up drain pipes and things like that. So, yeah, it's...
Of course,
it's,
yeah.
It was a prime time if you wanted to be a criminal in wartime.
Yeah, God. And that's a really good point. I even really thought, I went straight to murder, obviously, as, you know, crime readers, we tend to do that sort of thing. But yeah, even like the looting opportunities, that must have been.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. What a time to be alive then.
So this book is set in just the year after war, when
so many
people assume that the war is over, we can all get back to normal. And in fact, the reality I found when I started doing the research was that it was chaos for years. It depended where you were, whether you were in France or Germany that had been, you know, in the midst of all the battles. But it took years, and there were just millions of people wandering about, displaced, no homes, no families. So again, it's rife for people moving in and ghosting people in and out as well.
Yeah, of course. And I can't even imagine. I mean, I guess when you have no infrastructure left, when your whole country and everyone is facing the same thing around you, then you're just a number then as a displaced person. You know, it's not like there's a priority list. You're just one of many. So that's probably why it took so long to get around it, I guess.
It did. It got around it. And of course, then you've got all the emotions as well of that whole guilt of the nation, which I tackle in the book, and who's to blame, and the, you know, are the ordinary Germans to blame, and are ordinary Germans Nazis, you know, all of that. And the British were, of course, in Hamburg, especially in the northern parts of Germany, they were responsible for weeding out all the Nazis that had gone to ground and were hiding under sort of a normal identity, if you like. So there's quite a bit of that in the book, as well as the day-to-day things like the cigarettes being the main part of currency. So you had children trading cigarettes, which became very, very valuable, and, you know, picking them off the ground, and just very sad scenes, really.
Yeah, no, I thought that was fascinating. And you talked a bit about your research there, and I can only imagine this is a huge wealth of information available around this time period and things like that. But where do you begin with such a big setting for a book like
this? Well, there's less than war. It's not that people stopped writing about it, but there were less people writing about it. Interestingly, the publisher, Victor Galanz, went out to northern Germany, Hamburg in particular, and he reported back because he was so appalled at what was going on with all these poor families and displaced people and the hunger. So that was his work was really valuable. I go to the British Library. I do an internet trawl. I look at pictures. I found a great picture of some elephants actually uprighting from the zoo, from Hamburg Zoo, and they were being used like a forklift, upturning, you know, jeeps that had been bombed out and helping to get the place back to normal. And then I went to Hamburg for a good weekend and I met a fantastic guy called Gordon Drain, who was a guide. And then he just helped me beyond the remit of a guide. And he would do some trolling through German sites for me because I don't speak German. So he was a huge help for me.
That's an incredible resources then to help you get started. I mean, obviously you're an experienced historical writer at this point, but having the crime lens on it, did that make it a different experience for you in the research?
Oh yeah, definitely. When you're all but one of my other books or have been about in the middle of war, and war is like a stage. It gives you a stage. Mm. If you say the word war, people have an idea of what the Blitz looked like or what, you know, from things like all those wonderful programs like Foyle's War, for instance, you know, and all the settings that we've had, people actually know what war looks like. So you don't have to build a world in quite the same way. With post-war, you have to do a little bit more. But then, of course, war makes things happen. If you're looking for a plot driver or something that to move the plot along, you have a bomb exploding or a raid, or an air raid or something like that. And then that moves your characters along. But with the war gone, there were no raids. There were no, you know, apart from unexploded bombs, there were, you know, so you have to create things. And so for me, it was much, much harder and hats off to all the crime writers out there. You've got to keep that plot rolling and you've got to keep those little twists coming up all the time.
Well, I have to say, your book is not lacking in excitement at every turn. I would say you've paced it fantastically, but there is plenty of action in there. If you don't think you're going in post-war to no action, there's a lot going on in this book.
So I cheated slightly in the sense that I've come out of war with that stage, and then I've used there's half a scene going on there that I've put it onto. And then as I move further and further away from war, the next one is the set in the 1950s, then I've got more work to do in terms of plot. So I might need a bit of help with plot surgery next time.
So for the next one, are you staying with crime?
I'm staying with crime. I'm staying with the main character of Harry Schroeder.
Oh, fantastic.
Because Harry was actually a side character. Georgie Young was the main character in this book. And then I thought I'd write somebody. Obviously, there's usually a man-woman thing in the elements in my book. And you know, he just grew. He just grew and grew and grew. And I fell in love with Harry. And I'm still in love with him. So I thought I'd take him somewhere else.
I love that. And I love Harry too. And I just love the way that he interacts with the women around him as well. He's got this team and, you know, it's... Yeah, he's a great character. I'm excited to hear that his story continues.
Yes, he does. And he's, I mean, people will notice that he's more than a nod to people like Bernie Gunther in Philip Kerr's books, who I adore Bernie Gunther as well. I mean, I like my detectives sort of a bit irascible, a bit grumpy. You know, I'm sure we all like that. Got a pass, got a bit of a sort of slightly smudgy pass, but actually they're good guys through and through.
Yeah, good heart.
Yeah, they've done a few wrong things, but nothing terribly wrong in their lives. So
who among us? You
Harry
know?
Is more than a more than a nod to the wonderful Philip Kerr. And I like to think that they might have crossed paths at some point and met up in a bar in Berlin and moaned about the Kripo and moaned about being an officer in the Kripo.
Oh, well, that's a spin-off that needs to happen as well. Can you collaborate and write that? You know. But I also love Georgie. I think Georgie's an amazing character, and the journey that she goes on. How was that process writing from Georgie's perspective?
Yeah, well, I knew Georgie from book three. And the reason I did bring her back is that I had such a positive response from readers about Georgie, her being so feisty. I mean, all my women are feisty. I refuse to write women that are not forward in any way. But because she's a reporter, she's got that license to just to be really nosy and forthright. And at the end of book three, no spoilers, but there's a point where the war starts at the end of book three. And I thought, do you know what? I think I know what she does in war. I think she tours across Europe with her partner, her photography partner. And I think I know there's lots of daring do. She survives. You know, there's lots of battles. I really wanted to know what happened to people like Georgie when they had to go back into the world of women post-war. You know, so all those poor women from the factories that had made munitions and done all the heavy work, suddenly they had to then go back into the home because the men came back from the war, or a portion of them did, and they lost their jobs. Mm. And they lost a part of their identity as well. And they were expected to have babies and make tea and things like that. And so I wanted to know what Georgie would do in that situation. And to a certain extent, she runs away to Hamburg just to avoid it for a bit longer.
And all the better for us, because we get this amazing story out of it. So I'm very glad that she did. A question I always like to ask an author, and I'm very intrigued with this one, is if you had to be a character from your book, who would you be and why? Would it be Georgie?
I think it would be Georgie. Because I used to be a journalist, I think out of all the characters I've got, Georgie is probably the one that I wrote how I would have liked to have been. I was a terrible news reporter. Terrible. I was a much better feature writer. But I like to think that I would have been one of those really intrepid reporters, and I just wasn't. So I wrote her instead.
Well, she's a formidable character, so I want to be Georgie too. She is unreal. Was she based on anyone in particular when you first wrote of her? Or a mishmash of people?
I just read a really good biography of Martha Gellhorn, who was a brilliant journalist in her own right, a fantastic writer. She also just happened to be one of Hemingway's wives, which she always hated being quoted at. And she was really formidable during the war, and she went all sorts of places, and she got on the D-Day landings, and she stole away on hospital ships, and she, her life, her biography reads like a novel. It is incredible. So, and she's quite a flawed person as well. I don't think the biographer painted her in any other way, but she, you know, what she and people like Lee Miller as well, the photographer, you know, what they achieved as women going through across Europe as a battleground was incredible. So, yeah, I think there's definitely more than a nod to Martha Gellhorn there, Lee Miller, and all of those really good women. And there are a lot of women reporters as well.
Yeah, well, she is, as I say, quite a formidable character. And with your research, obviously you read a lot and you must have learned so much throughout your research process. How do you then boil that down and fix it into a story without just cramming it with information? How do you get that balance between the fact and the fiction?
Yeah, that is the tricky bit, because when you're scribbling away and you're thinking, oh, that's a really great piece of information, how can I shoehorn that in? You have to be really careful about the shoehorning. Any historical drama writer will tell you that. You have to pick and choose the little, what I call the golden nuggets of fact that you've to spin them around. And I like to think it's a bit like decorating a Christmas tree. You know, if you over decorate it, it's going to fall over, you know. And the tree is the core, is the plot, is the story. So you have to keep telling yourself why, or asking yourself, why is the reader reading this? They're reading it because it might be a good story, not because I'm telling them lots of facts which they can look up on the internet, or they can read a textbook like me, you know.
Yeah.
So I think you have to be really, really, it has to be a pick and mix of facts. I usually have one really good thing that I find, and that becomes my pivot. And so I did read that suitcases were like currency after the war. If you found a very good suitcase, it was very valuable. because not only could you put your things in it, you could actually sit on it, and it became somewhere to be. Like, and when people wow. sat on it, other people respected their space around them.
That's amazing.
And I thought, oh, that's it. That's my golden nugget. And so that was how the character of Meta comes out of it. And I built a whole character and a sort of whole, yeah, it, you know, it goes full circle from the suitcase back right round to the suitcase again.
Oh, yeah. There must be so many things you've learned that you couldn't put in. Are there any that you think, oh, maybe that one for the future, or that you're clinging on to for saving for later?
I have to say, I tend to move on. I tend to think I've done that, partly because I'm a person that gets bored quite easily. The one era that I would really go back to time and time and time again is the Cold War. I absolutely love spy books. I read spy books endlessly, and I am writing a spy book at the moment, and I would definitely write more. You know, I'm a big spy fan.
Oh, really?
Yeah, big spy fan.
Oh, that's a... Is your spy book set in that era?
My spy book is set in 1965, and I vowed that I could never do one that was modern day because I can't keep up the technology. I just wouldn't know.
Oh, I know.
No. I love
AI.
I can only do a one where you have to run into a phone box and leave a message in the phone box, you know, under the table or something like that, and then get somebody else coming in to retrieve the message.
That's even quite modern, really. Like I watched Notorious recently, you know, the Hitchcock film. Yeah, and he plays a piece of audio to Ingrid Bergman on a record. That they've sound recorded and captured a conversation between her and her father, but they played it on a vinyl. I was like, that was a great time.
Yeah.
You get a record.
Yes. And again, wow. You have to be really careful about your timings of things, your references to films and things like that, because even if it says it came out in 1965, you've got to then, is it early 65 or is it late 65? You know, those sorts of things.
And when was it they start filming it?
Absolutely. Yeah. You've got to be quite good about those sorts of things. Otherwise, someone will write to you and tell you you're wrong.
God, I can only imagine. Do you get those emails?
Sometimes. And sometimes you just have to put your hands up to it and say, I got it wrong. And it's fiction, you know.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? You're a fiction writer. As you said, you're not writing a textbook. You've got to play with the facts a bit to get to the fiction.
Yeah. So there are things that happen in my book that didn't happen. The riot isn't, there's a riot in it and it's not real. I made it up, but it would be the sort of thing that might have happened at that time.
Yeah. So beyond the realm of possibility, either a riot. Yeah.
Possible or probable, then that's okay in terms of the world of fiction, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I completely agree. And with the writing process, which we touched on a little bit, and you've written a few books now, has your process evolved or changed much in the many that you've written?
I think I've definitely got better of knowing where the arcs are, because any writer's got to get better at that, haven't they? Definitely.
Yeah.
I think your craft improves book on book. I would never be that person to rubbish your first book, because someone loved it enough to publish it. So, you know, I'm not one of those writers that would go, oh, that first book's terrible. But I think your craft gets better. I'm still a terrible pantser. And I've tried so hard to be a planner, and it just doesn't work. It doesn't work with me.
I find that fascinating with someone with as much research that you do, that you still pants. That's fascinating.
I'm a bit old school in that I have a notebook. I'm very old school. Everything goes in my notebook. Everything's sort of taped in it and written in it. And then once I've got my notebook together, I've got a synopsis that my editor is happy with, but it's only about a page, page and a half long. It's not that detailed. So I have a beginning. As long as I've got a beginning, I'm fine. The introduction is really important to get down. I've got a vague idea of the end. And then beyond that, it's like a snakes and ladders board. You know, I've got beginning at one end, the other corner is what happens at the end. And then I kind of wiggle my way around. And some days I don't even know what I'm going to write until I open the laptop. So.
Well, it clearly works for you though. It clearly works.
Well, the middle bit is pretty hard work. But then the middle bit of any book is quite hard work.
That's what every author I've ever had on has told me. The middle is always the worst bit.
Yeah. So but once you're through the middle, you seem to be on a, it's like a roller coaster. You seem to be on a roller coaster and you're sort of herring towards the end. So that's good.
Throw your arms
That's a really good bit when the writing becomes fun.
Oh, well, that's actually leads me on nicely to the question I like to ask is, what do you enjoy most and least about the writing process?
So yeah, the middle definitely is my least.
Yeah.
But my most is that bit where it's really flowing on a day. It is just like flying. It's like flying. But the other thing I also like is when a character like Harry or someone that's going to be a very minor character suddenly just grows and you can't stop writing them. You just can't. Oh, God, they've got to be. Oh, please get out of that scene. Get out of that. No, they've got to be in that scene. So you discover this character and it just blooms in front of your eyes. So that's the bit I think I like most. I'm not a very good editor either. I don't like killing my babies. So I am a writer that tends to underwrite rather than overwrite. So I don't have thousands of words to cut because I can't bear it.
I completely understand that. It would hurt me to have to delete it. So if you put loads of time into something as well and then just delete it, that's cruel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I try not to have to do that.
That's understandable. And what you're saying about the characters is also really interesting. I find that fascinating when a character tends to actually become real and take on a life of their own. And clearly that you've, you know, brought characters back in the past and Harry's continuing. What is it, do you think, about a character that makes them come to life in that way? Is it just as you write them, you develop them further and they form their own lives? Or do you kind of go in with a holistic sense of what they'll turn into?
No, I think the former, they grow in front of you and they grow a past. So sometimes I'll do a little bit of a CV for a character. On the odd occasion, you know, you have to ask them questions. What's your favourite colour? You know, what do you remember from your childhood? That sort of thing. I've tried that exercise before. Yeah, I think it's humanity. I think in all the really, really good detectives that we see, like in Morse, you know, and like Tom Thorne, Mark Billingham's Tom Thorne, and all that, they've got flaws. They've got humanity. You know, they're not perfect. They're not terrible. They're just people. And that's the other thing, is that the people in wartime, they were very tenacious. They were very, you know, gung-ho and let's just get on with it. But actually the same as people now. They need love. They need, you know, they love and hate. They need love. They want children. They need to eat. They need to sleep. You know, it doesn't change. Yeah. So I think as long as you've got humanity, then you're onto a good thing. And a bit of grumpiness. I think the grumpiness works very well.
Well, that's all part of your humanity, isn't it? Because no one's happy all the time.
No,
that would
exactly be
insufferable.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's what makes him relatable. I love that. And with your writing, a newer question I've started asking people is, what's a line you've written lately or from your catalogue that you're especially proud of?
Well, actually, I was thinking about this and there is one, and it does pertain to Harry, actually. He's just thinking about they've got no cars in the post-war. They've got no cars in the detective division. So they have to just walk or they have to take bikes. And so they've only got bikes that have got no tyres and some of them haven't got any wheels. And he says, a bone-shaking ride across the pocked concrete of Hamburg is not the worst of today's prospects for Harry Schroeder. The dead girl in the ruins will trump anything on his daily shit list.
Oh, that is a brilliant line. That is perfect. Well, after you write that one, that's a punch the air.
Yeah.
Downhill on the roller coaster moment.
He's the guy that wakes up and thinks, oh, what's on my shit list today?
Yeah. Yeah. And oh, God, this bloody bike, but it could be, there's worse to come.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, wow. That is a beautiful, beautiful line. And so I'm curious as well, you were saying about not wanting to kill, you know, your darlings to a degree. If you move more into crime, you're going to potentially be faced with the possibility of killing off people that you love in terms of your characters. How does that feel?
Yeah, I'm not good at that, I have to say. When I watch any kind of TV crime program, I'm there behind my eyes thinking, don't kill them off, don't kill those off. And I know you have to be really, really... Mick Herron's very good at that. I noticed that, you know, he's got that fantastic group of people in Slough House, but he is not afraid to kill off. the good ones. And so I think I've got to get braver. I think I've got to get braver about creating a likable character and maybe having to kill them off. So that's my learning curve in crime. That is definitely my learning curve.
Wow. Yeah, that I mean, as you put so much time, you spend so much time with the character, you grow them and develop them, and then it just feels so endlessly cruel to then just kill them. But for the story
is the key. It's the driver. It has to be the one that wins out all the time.
Oh, it is heartbreaking. Because which character in fiction's death devastated you most? Because everyone's got a few, or at least one
Atonement.
Or two.
The End of Atonement.
Oh my God.
I can't read that book anymore because I just think, oh no, you had
heartbreaking.
I think to Ian McEwan, you had the power not to kill them off, and you did. And it's just absolutely heartbreaking. Heartbreaking.
Oh, that's a really good one. Oh my God. Did you see the film?
Again, I
well?
Can't watch it anymore because it's just.
No, I don't blame you.
It's just too sad. Final.
Yeah, especially when you know what's coming and you're like, oh, I knew that was coming, and it's still devastating.
And absolutely all possible because that the flooding at that Balham tube, I've researched that and it did happen. But also entirely possible that he would, you know, just die of septicemia. Oh God, I've given up some spoilers now.
Just like a long, happy life though is also possible sometimes.
I mean, there and you know, luckily we got that sort of with Morse, didn't we? We knew that, you know, he would go into his 50s, 60s. At least he did that.
That's true. Oh, the one that still always gets me I love Poirot, but Poirot Curtain. Oh
yeah,
I don't know if you've read that. Devastating. Yeah, devastating stuff.
Oh dear, what do they do to us?
Yeah. That's I know these things we get involved with, honestly. But I guess also as well from like a if you kill them in a way, it's on your terms, if that makes sense.
Yes, and there's a good death. There's such a thing as a good death.
yes,
you know, that they don't just die in a hail of bullets. There's a reason for why you do it. But I think if you've had. I mean, I haven't had this, but of course there are writers out there that have had, you know, a whole series of books with one character, and then they're faced with that really horrible decision. Do you just let them go off into the sunset unwritten, or do you make it final, never to come back?
Oof. Gosh. Well, hopefully you won't get to that point with Harry and he'll just go on forever.
Yeah, no,
and
I see a nice life for Harry somewhere.
Good, good. That makes me feel a lot better. You write about, obviously, Germany post-war. It's a very, as you say, recognisable setting in a lot of people's minds. But where, in terms of your narrative, is it the location first for you in terms of getting to your story, or is it the period in history that drives the rest of it?
It's been the period of history, mainly because when you write First World War II novel, and then it sells quite well, then your publishers would like you to write some more. So,
sure.
Yes, I think it's been the fact that it's been wartime for me, but I am climbing out of that now into a different era.
Your post-war era.
Post-war era, yes.
Yes.
I think it is, but definitely location. You know, I've written a book about Venice because I absolutely love Venice. You know, I really like Berlin. I go to places that I just feel happy about, you know, going to visit. It's always good to go and do a nice research trip.
Well, you know, it's work. But also, so what can you do?
That's interesting that other people might not have read about. And because I haven't read about it much, I think, oh, let's go and do something there.
Yeah, untapped gold for you in those locations. Yeah. Oh, Mandy, it's been such a lovely conversation with you. I've really enjoyed it. And now, unfortunately, I have to confront you about something a bit awkward. Okay. I think you know what I'm talking about, Mandy. The elephant in the room here is that, unfortunately, you've committed a terrible crime, haven't you?
In what?
In life. For the purposes of this line of questioning.
What would that be?
You're not going to confess?
No, I haven't. No, I'm a good person, really. I think I'm a good person, really. I was a midwife for 20 years. You know, you can't even get a speeding ticket as a midwife.
No, that is hard. That is a hard one to push. But I don't know what you've done something, Mandy, because unfortunately, the crime you've committed was so bad that you have been sentenced to death for it.
Ah, okay. The death row thing. Right. Okay.
The death row thing.
My death row meal.
Yes, that's where I was getting to. I'm going to get you a meal. What would you like?
Definitely, I think it's lasagna. It's got to be lasagna for me with garlic bread, because it doesn't matter who I breathe on afterwards.
Very true. Go out with a bang. Homemade or from somewhere in particular?
Homemade, I think. Yeah, homemade.
Yeah?
Definitely.
Do you make a good one, or would it be someone close to you that makes a good one?
I make a decent one. I think it's probably not that authentically Italian, but I love Italian food. So yeah, I think I make a decent one.
That's the crime you've committed. It wasn't authentic enough, exactly. Your lasagna. And
I think probably I'd pass up on pudding, and I'd have to have some cheese and crisps as my final.
Perfect. Just to go with the garlic bread aromas. Yeah, yeah. I love that. With any particular brand of crisps or?
Yeah, I'm a bit old school. I'm a bit old school. I like Walker's cheese and onion. A bit old school there.
Classic. Yeah, simple. Absolutely. You can't beat it.
Fine.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, that's a great choice. An unusual choice. We haven't had any of those before, shockingly, but I'm delighted that they have something a bit different on the menu. Okay, well, you've had your lasagna, your garlic bread, and your cheese and onion. The person administering the way of killing you is in for a treat on your way out the door.
Them.
Yep. That might kill them as well before you've even got you. I don't know. But okay. Unfortunately, though, you are now dead. I'm very sorry to have to be the one to tell you that. Yeah. But the good news is that I will bury you with the book of your choice.
Okay.
So it's not all bad. What book would you be buried with?
I would be buried with a children's book called Harriet the Spy. And I read this when I was about 8 or 9 years old. And I used to carry it around with me in the school playground with my notebook, just like Harriet the Spy. And she wants to be a writer. She wants to be a writer. It's extremely funny. It's very wry. It's very sort of, it's children's book, but it's adult humour. It's just beautifully and brilliantly written, and it still makes me laugh, and I still read it today.
Wow. So you really have loved spy fiction your whole life, basically.
I have. I'm always, you know, I've always got my nose into a spy book or, you know, my kids are always saying, oh, God, if it's not World War II, it's spies, you know.
Well, they're both very interesting areas, so I could see the appeal for sure. Is that what inspired you to want to become a journalist and writer in your younger years?
Yeah, I mean, I always did want to write a book. There's no doubt about that. I did get waylaid. And when you're a journalist, I suppose, you know, even if you're a feature writer, it's never usually more than about 2,000 words. And I used to be done and dusted in 2,000 words. And I couldn't imagine that I could write anything longer than that. And it took until I'd had my children, become a midwife, done a good few years as a midwife, and suddenly the children were older and I thought, you know, I keep saying I'm going to write this book, I just have to go and do it. And because any writer knows, it doesn't write itself, you just have to get the words down. And
that's amazing.
And so that's when I did the MA in creative writing, and then just went, let's do it now.
That's incredible. And that's, I love that, because it's so, when you go down a career path like midwifery, where it takes you your whole life, essentially, you think that that will be your focus. But I'm so glad to hear, and thank God you did, you took this path as well.
Yeah. So for some time I was doing both. I was doing two side by side. But as the second book took off, then I decided, no, I think that the NHS had enough of me. 20 years was enough.
That's pretty good.
Not bad.
Yeah. Wow. I do feel really bad for having killed you now for that whole midwife thing.
You know, I'm like detectives, you know, there's some little part of me that did some misdeed somewhere, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, you know, crimes against lasagna are very serious. And as I'm part Italian, I take that seriously. So, okay. Fantastic. Well, Mandy, thank you so much for spending some time with me and telling me about your fantastic book, which everyone needs to go out and buy right now. Where can people follow you online?
They can follow me on Instagram. I think I'm Roboth and Mandy. They can follow me on Facebook, and I'm on Twitter as well.
Fantastic. Thank you. And the book is out now?
The book is out on the 29th of February. 29th. And it should be on audio, ebook, and paperback at the same time.
Fantastic. How do you feel about the audio versions of your books, by the way?
I don't listen to them only.
I was wondering if you did or not. Is it strange hearing it in another voice other than one in your
head?
Very
strange. And it's not because I think the people who do it are enormously talented. I have sat in on one of the sessions and it's really hard. It's really hard work. You know, it's not just like reading your own book. My friends always say to me, don't you read your own book? Oh, no, absolutely. It would take years to get it down. They are very, very talented, but it's just, no, I can't listen to it.
No, I understand. I get it. But, well, Mandy, I've taken up enough of your evening. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'll be back soon with another episode. And until then, oh, that's the other thing, Mandy. I never know how to end this podcast. So how should we end this?
We could just say, good night and good reading.
That's perfect.
How would you like to challenge your little grey cells while revelling in the vintage perfection of David Suchet's Poirot?
If so, then the Labours of a Hercule podcast was made for you.
We're taking a deep dive into every episode of this masterpiece of television and giving you the clues you need to solve the case along with Poirot himself.
We present the case and you solve it.
Whether you're a detective in the making,
or if you just simply want to gush over the genius and art decadence of Agatha Christie,
then subscribe now to the Labours of Hercule, wherever you get your podcasts.